This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. The British government has put UK shipping crews on notice. Stay away from the Strait of Hormuz for what is called an interim period after a British-owned tanker was seized by Iran. Another vessel has been released. Tehran said today the seizure was in response to Britain's role in impounding an Iranian supertanker earlier. A British government spokeswoman said today, "We remain deeply concerned about Iran's unacceptable actions, which represent a clear challenge to international freedom of navigation." British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt issued a warning.
We're not looking at military options. We are looking at a diplomatic way to resolve the situation. But we are very clear that it must be resolved.
A former British Royal Navy officer, Rear Admiral Chris Parry, says the Iranian regime has a blatant disregard for international maritime law. He was interviewed by Sky News.
They've done it before. They did it in the 80s. And it's a well-known tactic in the Straits of Hormuz. This is just blatant use of force against the international community, not just the US and the UK.
Here in Washington, counterterrorism expert Seth Jones is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says Iran seems to be calibrating its actions in the Gulf.
They didn't target a U.S. ship. They targeted a British tanker. So it's a way to respond without escalating too much. And it's just a seizure. It's not sinking it, so it's not an act of war. It's a calculated, careful response, I think, in a tit-for-tat now relationship between the U.S. and its allies and Iran.
A 42-year-old man from New York is back on U.S. soil, charged with fighting for the Islamic State terror group as a sniper before rising through the ranks to become an emir. Charges against Ruslan Maradovich Asainov were unsealed after the Syrian Democratic Forces handed him over to U.S. law enforcement. More news at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Lawyers for U.S. President Donald Trump's 2016 campaign say they want the use of former special counsel Robert Mueller's report as part of their defense against a Democratic National Committee lawsuit. AP correspondent Tim McGuire has a report.
A federal judge in New York says he might consider the Mueller report on Russian election meddling in a suit brought by the Democratic National Committee against the 2016 Trump campaign. The Democrats claimed in their suit that the campaign conspired with WikiLeaks, the Russians, President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, and others. Lawyers for the Trump campaign say those allegations might not stick, considering the report released in April found there was no collusion. The Democrats, who first wanted to use the report, now say the judge should note there is a report but not consider its contents. The judge didn't say when he would decide on the issue. I'm Tim McGuire.
Authorities in Canada have identified two people found dead on a British Columbia highway earlier this week. They are China Noel Deese from the U.S. state of North Carolina and Australian Lucas Fowler, the son of a police official in New South Wales. An RCMP spokesperson says it is still to be determined if the two had been targeted or were victims of a random crime. How they died has not yet been revealed. The World Food Program warns that nearly 2 million people in Mozambique are at risk of severe food shortages without urgent international assistance, the result of two destructive cyclones earlier this year. Lisa Schlein filed a report for VOA from Geneva.
Hundreds of people were killed, tens of thousands made homeless, and livelihoods lost when cyclones Idai and Kenneth hit Mozambique with devastating force in March and April. The destructive power of the two storms has wreaked havoc on the country's infrastructure and agriculture. Many crops that were about to be harvested and farm infrastructure were destroyed. The impact of these two disasters lingers on, threatening widespread hunger among survivors of these twin disasters. World Food Program spokesman Hervé Verhoosel says more than 1.6 million people are suffering from acute food insecurity, and the worst is yet to come.
That was Lisa Schlein reporting for VOA from Geneva. The World Food Program says it'll provide food assistance to more than a half million Mozambicans a month through October. A powerful bomb blast outside the gates of Kabul University in the Afghan capital on Friday killed at least 8 people and wounded 33 as students and lawyers waited to take an examination. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. A day earlier, Taliban insurgents set off 2 car bombs outside a police headquarters in the southern city of Kandahar, killing at least 12 and wounding more than 80. More news at voanews.com. Gene Randall, VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
People are very apprehensive. I don't know whether you are aware of the abortion John letter, which is also in line with what you are saying, saying that we are on the thinkable, the level of insecurity, and these people should, each region should now resort to self-help.
A prominent Nigerian traditional ruler expresses concern about the rising insecurity challenges across the country.
Executive by a president has breached his oath of office and allegiance to the Constitution. That politician has got an obligation to allow conscience to speak to him or her and voluntarily step aside.
A major South African opposition party demands the impeachment of President Cyril Ramaphosa.
Until now, that matter is still in the office of the Honorable Acting Chief Justice, has not been allocated, and there is a clear intention that the application, which raises very important constitutional issues, does not see the light of the day.
And the Lesotho Law Society files a court petition to prevent the Prime Minister from suspending the appeals court precedent. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Of Ife Adeyeye and Itan Babatunde Ogunwusi Ojaja II has expressed concern about the ongoing security situation in the country. The monarch met with President Muhammadu Buhari this week following the escalation of kidnappings, armed robbery, and violence carried out by militants. His remarks came after the government said it is committed to improving the security situation in the country. Despite criticism, it has failed its core constitutional mandate to protect life and property. For the latest development, I read Chudi Chukwani, an economist and political analyst based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
I believe the general feeling, to be truthfully honest, Nigerians are a little bit tensed up with all the insecurity issues. And a lot of people are now planning to resort to self-help. And when that happens, that's the beginning and the end of Nigeria.
But Chudi, I spoke with an official of the government who says they are busy trying to bolster security across the country to protect life and property as mandated by the Constitution. You don't think that is enough? Why?
Yeah, but you have to be practicalized, not just saying it. What is happening in Nigeria today is that there's a daily incident. Like today, there was a report that some soldiers were killed by ambush by Boko Haram in the northeast. There were also reports that some soldiers were kidnapped in Akwa Ibom. So daily, you get all these reports. So if you say you are doing some security architecture or you are trying to exercise the powers and your responsibilities as contained in the Constitution, yes, that is your responsibility. You don't have to tell anybody that. We all know that. We need to see action on the ground. We need to see you secure major places, like the road between Abuja and Ondo State, the road between Abuja and Ore, the road between Abuja and Enugu, Abuja to Lagos. People should not be thinking twice whether they should travel on these roads. The road between Abuja and Kaduna, those places should be safe places of passage. Those are our major economic roads. So if you are doing something, secure those roads. Make sure that people can travel freely. Goods and persons can travel freely. That is the whole idea of commerce. We must have free commerce and free movement of people, you know, in the country. I'm happy that the Senate said they are calling a security summit. But to most of us, we are tired of summits. Some of these things should be practicalized on the ground. I know, with any doubt in my mind whatsoever, the Nigerian military and the Nigerian security forces have the capability to secure this nation.
The ONI said he was at the villa to meet the president due to the rising insecurity challenges in the country. He cited instances of kidnapping, armed robbery, and insurgency in the northeast. Are people expressing concern about this, and what has been the effort of the government? Because some people are even calling for the firing of all security chiefs in the country because they said they have failed the president in carrying out his duties to protect life and property.
Yes, my sense is that a lot of people are very, very much in support of what the army says. And the response from the government has not been as forthcoming as is expected. And as I said, whatever the response of government should be, has to be practicalized. It has to be on the ground, not by speeching. You know, people have to see some movement, you know, of things on the ground that secure the nation. So a lot of people are very, very apprehensive. I don't know whether you are aware of the Abakanjon letter, which is also in line with what the army is saying, saying that we are on the tinkerboard, the level of insecurity, and these people should, each region should now resolve to self-help.
Some are saying that the government, and for that matter, the president, hasn't shown leadership when it comes to growing insecurity concerns in the country. What are your views, and what are the views on the ground?
The views on the ground is that I believe that the people surrounding the president, the senior advisors surrounding the president, are coming up with this idea that if the president should take an action in acknowledging the outcry from the public, it would be a sign of weakness or a sign of failure. But that is wrong. The whole issue of leadership is that it's got the whole issue of democratic leadership. I just need to underscore that one. Democratic leadership is government of the people, by the people, for the people. So the by the people means that the people have the right to point out issues of concern to you, who is they have voted in or elected to be their leader. And you have a responsibility to listen to them and do what they want. So that advice being given to him by these very close people at the highest level of the presidency is absolutely wrong. He doesn't know, need those people around him. And that is what is causing the tension. He needs to get rid of all of them and listen to the people of Nigeria and do what is right.
Chudi Chukwuani is an economist and political analyst who spoke with me from Abuja. The Secretary General of the Sierra Leonean Main Opposition All People's Congress, or APC, says the party plans to seek legal redress next week to challenge an order to force former ministers to declare their assets. Osman Fode Yansene says the move is a witch hunt aimed to demonize former President Ernest Bai Koroma's administration officials. His remarks came after the Commission of Inquiry issued a public notice which called on ministers in the former government to declare their assets between 2007 and 2018 by August 10. For reaction, I reach Osman Fode Yansene, Secretary General of the Sierra Leonean Main Opposition Party, All People's Congress, or APC.
What we know is that it is not supported by any law. Fair hearing is not only guaranteed at the trial, but starts at the investigation phase. Therefore, a person of interest to the commission or a suspect or an accused, we believe, is entitled to, one, the right to remain silent, two, the presumption of innocence, three, the privilege against self-incrimination, and four, we believe that the time-old principle of establishing the guilt of the person of interest or suspect or accused, and that burden is on the accuser. Any attempt to reverse the onus will lead to the violation of the constitutional rights of individuals. We need a statement, and we are going to of explanation from the commission, and we accordingly informed our lawyers to do so.
But Mr. Yansen, some are suggesting that if you have nothing to hide, why should they be opposed to asked to declare their assets if they have nothing to hide?
No, they have nothing to hide. That is why they declare their assets before and after leaving office. So this is just to create a situation where accusations have been bandied around, just like during the military regime. The period of the military regime, somebody will just come and say, Mr. X has this, has this, has this, has, and you are arrested and detained. They have a simple system of finding out what belongs to anybody. You cannot get an asset if you have a house, for example, it is going to be registered under the Administrator General's office. So why don't they go there and find out who and who owns this, who owns it? Some ministers and some even presidents and vice presidents have been accused of having over 200 houses. These are just vague accusations. They have also even said that people should now go and give evidence that they know the properties of such and such a person. We are saying that the people are already under the commission. The onus is on the government to find out what belongs to who. This system is clear. under the Anti-Corruption Act. So that is why we are saying the initial attempt is to demonize the APC ministers, president, etc., when they brought in that DPC report, which was skewed against the APC, which was skewed against only ministers and not civil servants, who in the main are the vote controllers, who in the main are the chairman of procurement committees. So this is why, if it is not politically motivated, it is easy for somebody to easily subscribe to it. But this is to molest people and make the country very, very unstable.
Your party is going to seek legal redress to challenge this order from the government. However, some Sierra Leoneans are also saying that they voted for this government because of its determination to fight against corruption, and that all what your party is doing is to stifle and kick against a lawful decision and mandate by the government to fight corruption. What do you say about that?
No. Corruption should have started by being an all-inclusive process, not a selective process that was determined in their GPT report. I have told you that the GPT report came and targeted only president, vice president, ministers of the APC. We are also against corruption. We've said it several times. So for people to say that when rules are skewed just as we go along, this is why we insisted that in the commissions of inquiry, there has to be rules of engagement. We don't start creating new rules as we go along. That is what is happening. The other time they said people of interest must come in person. If they do not come, they will be arrested. This is all threat. We have legal representation. If the lawyers go there, as the commission had started doing, they just came in March and said, if you don't go, you'll be arrested. All intimidation. This is what we are saying.
Osman Fode Yansene is the Secretary General of the Sierra Leonean Main Opposition All People's Congress, or APC. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. South African Opposition Party Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF, has called for the impeachment of President Cyril Ramaphosa. Godrich Gadi, General Secretary for the South African Opposition Party, says the EFF would seek for the formation of a parliamentary commission aimed to remove the president from office. His remarks came after an anti-corruption organization accused the president of deliberately misleading parliament regarding a 35,900 campaign donation in 2017, which helped his bid to become the president for the ruling party, the African National Congress, or ANC. For more reaction, I reach Godrich Gadi, General Secretary for the South African Opposition Party, the EFF.
The president could not even provide the list of the people who provided the 500 million rand. The public protector says, we need the list of the people who donated the 500 million rand because we don't know what are their intentions. What do they expect from you once you are in power? However, here are red flag transactions that we were able to pick up from the account of the CR17 trust campaign account inside the ANC. So the president has got a lot to answer. That 500,000 rand is, by the way, it triggered everything because that 500,000 rand was received from a company that has got almost a monopoly of all tenders in South Africa. And that company belongs to a stalwart of the ANC, Mr. Watson.
Based on this report, how does the president's promise to weed out corruption stand at the moment regarding what the EFCC sees as the fight against corruption in South Africa?
Does not have the moral ground to say he can fight corruption. The question is still yet to be asked. Did they pay the donation tax of about 20% to the South African Revenue Services? So there is no difference. It's a continuation of looting and the capture of the state for corrupt conduct. It was a capture of the state by the Gupta Indian family together with Zuma. And today, it is the capture of the state by the monopoly capital of the Stellenbosch Mafia. There's a family of whites who stay in Stellenbosch, the Rupert, the Rothschilds, the Oppenheimers, who are actually controlling the president and the ANC.
So what is next in this regard, since it is clear that the South African anti-corruption watchdog said Friday that President Cyril Ramaphosa misled Parliament about the gift?
He should have known better when the question was being asked. At least he should have said, Madam Speaker, I do not have facts about this question that is being asked. May I be given an opportunity in the next round of questions to the president? I will come with the answer, or I will send a written response. But he thought he knows too much. He didn't know what the opposition had as a proof of the corrupt donation to his campaign. And then he answered and tried to clean himself and his son out of the corrupt transaction of 500,000 rands. So there we are. He should have known better. He's an astute politician, highly experienced, very senior in the ANC. He should have known better that you don't just give answers inside parliament like that.
What is the stance of the EFCC after Nkwebani, who investigates allegations of wrongdoing by state officials, told South African local media that President Ramaphosa had violated the constitution and breached executive code of ethics by telling parliament he did not know his son was involved in the donation?
The EFF holds a view that where a determination has been made beyond a reasonable doubt that a public representative, particularly a member of the executive and the president, have breached their oath of office to uphold, defend, and promote the constitution, they have to do the honorable thing, stepping aside voluntarily to go and clear their name.
Talking about impeachment, some people are saying since the public prosecutor is saying he has violated the constitution, then he should step down or be impeached. Is that the stance of the EFCC?
The stance of the economic freedom fighters is that once a determination has been made that an executive or a president has breached his oath of office and allegiance to the constitution, that politician has got an obligation to allow conscience to speak to him or her and voluntarily step aside. Failure which, as the public protector has directed, that public representative and member of the executive must face consequences in parliament through processing through a special committee that will be set up by the parliament to commence the impeachment process.
Godrich Gadi is the general secretary for the South African Opposition Party, the EFF. He spoke with me from Johannesburg. The Law Society of the Kingdom of Lesotho has filed a High Court petition seeking to prevent Prime Minister Thomas Thabane's suspension of Kananelo Mosito, president of the Appeals Court. The Law Society contends that the Prime Minister's decision to suspend the Appeals Court president will undermine the independence of the judiciary. The Prime Minister, in a critical letter, alleged the Appeals Court president was interfering in the duties of the acting Chief Justice. To learn more about the court challenge, I read Tekani Makakachani, president of the Law Society of Lesotho.
Essentially, what the Prime Minister is complaining about are matters within the competence, domain, purview, and performance and function of the court. And thus, they relate to matters judicial, and which, in terms of the separation of power, which is a structural doctrine within our constitution, constitute an infringement by the executive on the domain of the judiciary. And secondly, it interferes with the independence of the judiciary and consequently the public trust in the judiciary will be taking a further nosedive, and that will affect the administration of justice. And consequently, because of this, we felt that we are bound to approach the High Court exercising its constitutional jurisdiction to interdict the Prime Minister from taking this intended course, because in our view, It was a clear violation, a naked infringement of the constitutional principles of separation of powers and the independence of the judiciary.
Some are arguing that the Prime Minister has a constitutional mandate to appoint or disappoint leaders of the judicial system. So what the Prime Minister did was constitutional. Why do you differ?
That argument is devoid of truth. Like I said, we have a constitutional separation of powers. The Constitution, nonetheless, places certain procedures for appointment for the President of the Court of Appeal as well as the Chief Justice of the Kingdom of Lesotho. And when it comes to the issues of removal or the impeachment, the Constitution is very clear in terms of Section 125(3) of our Constitution that the President of the Court of Appeal can be removed from office only when the following jurisdictional facts are established, and that is inability to perform the functions of the office of the President of the Court of Appeal, and that inability must be one that arises from infirmity of body or mind or any other cause. Secondly, it is for the reasons of misbehavior that impeachment processes may begin. So none of these jurisdictional facts are established. In fact, the letter of the Prime Minister of the 5th July 2019 is a far cry from even approaching to consisting of allegations of incapacity or inability and or misconduct.
Looking at the suit that you filed against the Prime Minister, how independent is the judiciary to ensure that you get a favorable ruling?
That is a very important question. I can tell you that the issue of the independence of the judiciary, the events with which we are concerned here, seem to be further subjecting the problems that we are already having in our jurisdiction, as well as affecting the independence of the judiciary. It is just an indication of that. But we still have the problem of the independence of the judiciary. The reasons for that are both structural and political. And a number of incidences have taken place which are a clear indicia or indication that we are still having a problem to grapple with the issue of the independence and autonomy of the judiciary. I will tell you now that the matter which the Law Society has brought, has instituted, had to come before the Honorable Acting Chief Justice to allocate that same matter. That was on the 10th and the 11th of July 2019, but it is until now that matter is still in the office of the Honorable Acting Chief Justice, has not been allocated, and this is a clear intention that the application, which raises very important constitutional issues, does not see the light of the day.
Tekani Makakachani is the president of the Law Society of Lesotho. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the World Food Programme warns 1.9 million Mozambicans battered by two devastating cyclones earlier this year are at risk of severe food shortages without urgent international assistance. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Hundreds of people were killed, tens of thousands made homeless, and livelihoods lost when cyclones Idai and Kenneth hit Mozambique with devastating force in March and April. The destructive power of the two storms has wreaked havoc on the country's infrastructure and agriculture. Many crops that were about to be harvested and farm infrastructure were destroyed. The impact of these two disasters lingers on, threatening widespread hunger among survivors of these twin disasters. World Food Program spokesman Hervé Verhoosel says more than 1.6 million people are suffering from acute food insecurity, and the worst is yet to come.
It is expected that the upcoming lean season will be very difficult in Mozambique, with just below 2 million people projected to be in a crisis situation if there are no humanitarian intervention before. The lean season is the period from October of this year until the next harvest season in March 2020.
Verhoosel says WFP is planning to assist more than 560,000 people every month through October in both cyclone and drought-affected areas. He says his agency hopes to scale up its humanitarian operation when the lean season kicks in October. If the money is available, he says WFP will provide food rations to 1.25 million people every month until March, when the next harvest season begins. He says WFP will need slightly more than $100 million to implement its recovery plan over the next 6 months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Small-scale Zimbabwean female miners have raised allegations of corruption by officials in the Ministry of Mines and Mining Development over mining claims. For VOA, Ade Gondo gives us more on the story from Bulawayo.
During the recent Women in Mining Conference, artisanal women miners described cases in which mining ministry officials awarded claims to them, then corruptly gave the same claims to others, creating confusion and disrupting their work. The conference was organized in conjunction with the Zimbabwe Miners Federation, which represents some 45,000 mining entities. The women say Shurugwe Province's Marashongwe mining claims were ceded to government by mining companies in Moscow and awarded to a group of six women miners in 2002. Joyce Chibendera said her group was evicted from the site June 12th by alleged ruling party youths.
Sustakatanga kumaina chrome 2002 are my tributes as Masco.
She says that she started mining chrome in 2002 and invested a lot of money in the project. That while they were mining, they heard that government had taken 50% of the claims, and they were told that as sitting tenants, they could continue mining. But they were surprised when news came on the 12th of June to evict. They said they had a letter from the police under the instructions of the provincial mining director. She said the women's application for a special grant came in 2016 compared with 2018 for the notorious machete-wielding youths. Chibendera, a former ZANU-PF chairperson for Shurugwe Urban, explained.
They just said, go, if you are to come back, you will be arrested. Yes, they have a letter from the police. They are using our small houses, which we are using, these youths. We left our tools at the mine.
The ruling party youths in the Midlands are notorious for grabbing mining claims and disrupting mining activities with impunity. Police appear to be powerless to act against them, especially when the youths have official documentation for their claims. Onesimo Moyo, the permanent secretary in the Ministry of Mines, vowed to send a fact-finding mission and called it an isolated case. But the women's representatives insist chaos and corruption are rampant. They allege that ministry and party officials collude to wrest potentially lucrative mining claims from vulnerable women applicants. Chiedza Chipangura, who is the Zimbabwe Mining Federation's Mashonaland West chairperson, weighs in on the matter.
So what will happen is an ordinary miner you'd want to do the legal thing, you register your claim. The moment that they know that there is money there is all their good grave, they'll come and say they've got papers. So you end up having two owners pay claim.
Chipangura says the moment there is a disputed claim, the lawful procedure should be for both parties to stop operations, but that machete gangs continue working.
But those guys, they don't stop. They use the political muscle. They'll claim that the ruling party's blessing to do that. So we wonder, you know, the power behind even that political muscle. But as women as well, you feel threatened. In my province, in Mashweso, we had a woman who had her breast slashed.
The second vice president of the Zimbabwe Mining Federation, Lindi Mpofu, believes the women miners face losing their livelihoods.
It's been very commonplace. I mean, look, over the past years, you do realize that the corruption has been rampant.
Mpofu says introducing a new computerized system detailing the claims belonging to a person should help ease the problem. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo.
Most people know that New York is as a world capital for great theater, both on and off Broadway. Considered the National Black Theater, or NBT, for 50 years, NBT has been Harlem's and the world's mecca for African-American playwrights, actors, and directors. VOA's Adam Phillips has more from behind the scenes.
You, our ancestors are talking to us. They're telling us, if we seek first the kingdom of Africa, all good things shall be added.
That is an Afrocentric celebration led by activist, actress, and producer Barbara Ann Teer in the early days of the National Black Theater, which she founded in 1968, the year civil rights leader Martin Luther King was assassinated. Black activism and rave were at their peak at that time.
America was on fire.
Charlie Lithcott is Barbara Ann Teer's daughter. She's directed the theater since her mother's death in 2008.
All of that was going on when she decided to move her family from downtown uptown to Harlem and create communities that could, with the right spiritual environment, also begin to heal this blood memory. Putting these black bodies on stage, telling their unapologetic, raw truth as they see it, was revolutionary.
Then and now, NBT was strongly committed to social justice. Recent productions include Black Girls Are From Outer Space, which celebrates the beauty of black women and girls in light of the Me Too and Black Lives Matter movements.
I'm a pawn in the main criminal's war strategy.
And that's a small snippet of The Peculiar Patriot, Liza Jesse Peterson's smash one-woman show about the impact of the war on drugs and the mass incarceration of African Americans. Here's what one audience member had to say following the show.
It really showed how the prison industrial complex doesn't just affect the inmates, it also affects the families, it also affects the friends. You know, you're taking fathers away from their sons, mothers away from their daughters.
The National Black Theater often collaborates with other New York cultural institutions, such as the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture and Carnegie Hall, whose Great Migration series focused on the northward 20th century migration of African Americans from the rural South. NBT's presentation, Perpetual Flight, The Movement of the Black Body, addresses many other African-American eras as well, from slavery through Reconstruction, the Back to Africa movement, and the Civil Rights movement. Sade Lithcott notes that today, the rapid gentrification of black neighborhoods by affluent whites is raising rents, forcing many longtime black residents to flee yet again.
What we wanted to really demonstrate was that we've actually been in perpetual flight since we were ripped from Africa. And in particular, this idea of migration being multifaceted, having all of these different agitation moments in our history and in our country.
Being black is itself multifaceted, says NBT's longtime artistic director, Jonathan McCrory.
The idea of black can't be monolithic. The idea of African American can't be monolithic. That's what society wants us to think. But in actuality, the nuance of it is what has to be given its precious space. It has to be very individual. And that's what makes it complicated and also dangerous. Because to not be able to pin it onto something means you can't destroy it, or you can't control it, or you can't capitalize on it. And theater is the one form that holds it all.
The National Black Theater also supports and develops musical theater that focuses on Africa itself.
Okay.
Oh. This is a rehearsal of Wildflower, the true story of a young woman who left apartheid South Africa for the U.S. at the urging of a traditional healer. MBT brought Wildflower's African-American creators to South Africa to experience the country firsthand while developing the show. As the National Black Theater enters its sixth decade, Sade Lithcott is proud of what it's producing, but says that entertainment isn't the only or perhaps even the main point.
What I hope lingers is the spirit of this place. Where are the spaces we can come and cry and laugh and hold each other and be assured that there will be a tomorrow?
That means building bridges to New Yorkers of every race and background.
We live in such a divisive time where everything is being curated for us to be separated. But at the core of it all, we're human beings. That's the secret subversive experiment of the National Black Theater. It is totally black, but it is totally human.
NBT is beginning an ambitious renovation of its performance space. Meanwhile, it is literally taking to the streets. The show, 125th and Freedom, explores Harlem's main thoroughfare with ritual dance and performance that highlight the community's challenges while celebrating its capacity for authentic healing. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You're hearing from Waiki Benda with Muna Kampala, then Diamond Platinums featuring Khadija Kopa will come your way with Nasema Nawi, Rema and Chris Evans come your way with Linda, and then Mafiki Zolo with Love Potion. Namulabila kutele, nanguisa kelele, ntambuza kanyege nyege, wagana njakumile mbeke, superstar bichi, movie star bichi.
Baby, in Golden Hour.
Nasema nawe, 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 nasema nawe tugata gwe mukwano guno tokuzanyisa kukwate mpola tokuita kuyomba na olaba kangali wesenga nkulize ani totuka olwayo munange obanga gamba tife nayenga nkukozeki
doing? What is it that you done to me, oh? Eh, jalonga tamanga, sala teta ngawe. Did you pour me a love potion, oh? My babe, I can't stop thinking about you. Undenza Antonio, kuthenga la lebusuku. Estando sami, baby, I've been thinking about you. Undenza Antonio, kuthenga la lebusuku. Estando sami.
Baby, there's no one but you. All that I need, baby, it's you, you, you. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Imagine life without you. Stand by some, I'm thinking about you. Ditala ni teta ni teta ngawe. Tala ni pupa ngawe. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. What is this Antonina? I just can't stop thinking about you. Baby, all I want is you. Baby, there's no one but you. Go by, you give me the juice. You bring me the juice. On dance, I'm turning now. I just can't stop thinking about you. On dance, I'm turning now. Good thing, la la, let's go. Stand with some
Potion by Mafiki Zolo and music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, cross the river in a crowd and the crocodile won't eat you. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm David Byrd.